Welcome to Influential Visions. Here, we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. My name is Nathaniel Schooler, and I am your host today. Well, hello, everyone. I am interviewing Nazir Ahmad, or Naz, and he's a consultant vascular surgeon and clinical director for the MARS project, which is the Manchester Amputation Reduction Strategy. And also, you're also the clinical director for the aneurysm screening program. Congratulations, because I know that's a big a new role that you've got. So. I think before we dig into like what data stuff you're doing and what great groundbreaking things you're actually doing with technology in hospitals, I'd like to learn more about you not speaking for 5 years, because like you didn't speak when you were a child, right? For 5 years.
That's right. Yeah. Well, thanks for having me, Nat. That's right. I mean, although I'm a vascular surgeon now, my path into becoming a vascular surgeon wasn't a normal path that people follow. So you're absolutely right. I was a very late developer. I didn't learn to speak until I was 5 years old. In fact, when I was in school, I used to hate going to school. And this was back in the sort of late 70s, early 80s. And my sister had to actually tie my hands and my feet together to physically take me into school. And then when I got into school, the teacher in primary school had to sort of lock the door so I didn't run out.
No way.
So, and then because I didn't speak, I was always quite a late developer. And I think also because I was born in August as well, right at the end of August. So when you're a kid, you're the youngest in the year. And so you're a late developer from that reason as well. So I was a late developer anyway because I didn't speak. And then on top of that, I was the youngest. And so so that kind of followed me throughout the whole of my school career. So I left school. For my GCSEs, I got a grade U in maths. And for my A-levels, I got a D and two E's. Now, I managed to retake my maths and got a C second time round. Yeah. But, you know, I left with a D and two E's in A-level and then went on to do a degree. Managed to get myself into a university in those days, you could, and then went on to do medicine afterwards.
That's super. And now you've actually got 5 degrees now, right?
I've got 5 degrees. So I've got my normal degree, and then with medicine, you become a doctor, and then when you become a surgeon, you become a mister. And then I went on to do a PhD and became a doctor again. So in my life, I've been a master, Mr. Doctor, Mr. Doctor. You can use any one of those titles.
Wow. Well, I think it's great that you're actually bringing a data-led approach into an age-old profession, which, you know, all right, it's you do amazing things, yeah. But like before we sort of get into that, what does a vascular surgeon actually do, like day to day?
Oh gosh, that's a good question. So there's sort of three aspects to our job. The first is we do clinics, and people with vascular problems come and see us. So the common things are people have what we call an aneurysm, which is swelling in one of their blood vessels. They have either post stroke, having had a stroke, they've got blockages in their arteries, so we clear those arteries. And we offer advice on how to manage cardiovascular risk factors, and we do operations which are mainly around blood vessels. That's basically what a vascular surgeon does on a day-to-day basis.
Okay. So you deal with like really serious like stabbing incidents, and like when other surgeons like have a serious problem, you're the guy that gets called and you rush off, you get to the hospital, and you deal with like really life-threatening problems, yeah?
Yeah. So we do a lot of trauma. So mainly stabbings and shootings, anything that causes bleeding, you basically need a vascular surgeon for. And also other surgeons, when they're operating, sometimes they can cause bleeding. It's just part of the process, and they often call a vascular surgeon in to fix those blood vessels. So in my time, although my primary role is a vascular surgeon, I've gone to help out transplant surgeons, pancreatic surgeons, and sort of a whole host of surgeons to help them with bleeding issues, and just sort of come in and save the day, really. That's what we do.
Amazing, amazing. And I know when I was listening to you speak on stage, Oracle in the PR room, I thought it was very interesting, and I wanted to interview you. And it's taken us how long? What, 3 months? Oh,
3 months to get together, yeah.
Because you've been working ridiculous amounts of hours, obviously with the current COVID. I mean, recording today, it's the 11th of May today, right? So you know, recording this now, what are we? We're 8 weeks into this situation, aren't we? Pretty much. How has like the hospital and what you do changed like in the last 8 weeks?
Gosh, we've completely changed the way we work. Our thresholds for operating on people has gone right up, simply because when you operate on somebody, you take up an anesthetic machine. And what the data from China showed is that people with COVID, if they have an operation, their mortality rate is extremely high. So we've avoided operating on people if at all we can. We often do what we call endovascular revascularizations. So we are trying to do sort of keyhole surgery on many of these patients, okay, where you just put a balloon or a stent in to try and get people in and out of hospital within a day or two.
Right.
So that's one way that it's completely changed. We try not to operate. The operations that I have done, when you put the full PPE mask on and the gown and visors and all that, it's really, really hard operating.
Yeah.
Because the mask is so tight, it's actually quite difficult to breathe. And you end up with a headache and feeling quite claustrophobic with that on. Wow. And many of my colleagues have, you know, middle of an operation, I've just had to go out, just take the mask off, just to breathe, to be able to do that. So, and then sort of concentrating for long periods of time, and particularly the sort of operations I do where, you know, each stitch is only a millimeter apart or a bit of a millimeter away. It's that sort of precision sort of operating that we do. You need your full faculties with you at all times. And, you know, one of those things, you need a bit of oxygen to be able to breathe to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's how that's changed. But now that it's sort of calming down a bit, we're hoping to go back into more normal modes of operating, although it's still going to be completely different to the way it was, say, 3 months ago.
Yeah, that's it must be really, really quite difficult to see, probably at times as well, you know, through that that visor. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that opens up the sort of the future for robotic operations? So you put your hands into the controls of a robot for these things or what?
Yeah. So I mean, it's that's already being done in some operations. So certain surgeons use robots in their operations where they operate them remotely. That technology hasn't reached vascular surgery yet because the technology needed isn't quite ready yet. What a robot can do isn't quite the same as what you need a surgeon to do for this particular type of surgery. For this type of surgery, it's relatively okay, and it's being done and it's being piloted successfully. But that doesn't quite work for vascular surgery. The sort of angles that you need and the thinking involved, it's just not quite there yet.
Yeah. But I think, you know, in the future, do you see that sort of developing in your space?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's going to be used in two ways. One is training future surgeons, because you can't. You may not want to hear this, but the way I learned operate is actually operating on people. That's how you learn.
Right.
Just like a pilot, the first time a pilot lands a plane is usually when it's full of passengers. So it's the same with a surgeon. Now that's just the way I've grown up and the way it's always been done. But to an outsider, that might sound a bit strange. But that's how we do it.
Yeah, but you have someone there who makes sure that you're doing it right. I mean, you're not just let loose with a scalpel,
yeah.
Are you?
I just let you loose. You are given a bit of training. You got to watch a few before you do it. Although most of the there is an old surgical adage, which is watch one, do one, teach one. the way the future is you know 3D operating in a fully immersive environment and developing a whole team approach to an operation. It's not just you operating, it's a whole team around you, and you've got to simulate that stress and to be able to develop that and then operate under those is where the future of training is, and that's where tech and AI is absolutely crucial. Definitely.
Yeah, and virtual reality must be the developments in those sort of areas. I'm quite interested in AI and AR and VR and stuff. It's but I think you're involved with a lot of really cutting edge stuff actually. And for people who don't really know about this Mars project, the amputation reduction strategy that you're rolling out in Manchester is actually very cutting edge, because that actually represents 10 years of work that you've put in to understand these amputations, right? So you've basically created a database with over 100,000 data points, is that right? Or 100,000 images? How does that?
Yeah, sure. So it's part of my doctoral thesis. I looked at inequalities in amputations across England over a 10-year period. So I got data for 100,000 amputations performed in England over 10 years. Oh. And just to give a bit of background, there's one, what we call a minor amputation. That's everything below the ankle every hour in England. And one major amputation every 2 hours in England. So there's a huge number of amputations. These are amputations that are not due to trauma or cancer. These are due to chronic disease like diabetes, like peripheral arterial disease, things like smoking, they lead to that. And so there's a huge number of amputations that are done every year in the country. But if you look at it, it's not evenly spread. So the prevalence of amputations is 3 times higher in men compared to women. And it's 30% higher in the north of England compared with the south. And it also varies in different ethnic groups as well. And the only reason I know, and the only reason I know that is because I took 100,000 amputations, got data for that, and then looked at the patterns, looked at the regional gender and ethnic variations in that. And to be able to do that, I created a database of, it was about 1,000 columns and about 90 million rows of data. And from that, I had to extract the 100,000 amputations and 350,000 revascularizations, and then put that across where they are going on in England, and then get that published. And I was one of the first people to describe that in the country, probably about 3-4 years ago now. And then from that, that raised the whole idea of health inequalities around amputations, and then managed to put a funding project together to develop the Mars project, which is addressing the inequalities in amputations through what we call a whole systems analysis.
Wow. And so there can be many different variables, right? I'm really interested in e-health, yeah? And so in essence, it's going to develop into something that is far from what it was 5 years ago. I mean, we're if you think about when they launched the iWatch, right? And then, which I love my iWatch 5, right? Like I queued up in Silicon, where was I? Berkeley last year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I was at Oracle, I was at Open World. And so I'll tell you a funny story. Yeah. So okay. I was basically just about to go and stay at my sister who lives in Silicon Valley with her husband. He works at Google. She works at Intel. Okay. So I basically booked this Airbnb, which was expensive. Yeah. I'd just been staying in like the Hilton or something with Oracle. Right. So I was like, okay, I'm going to save some money. Cause I was staying for 5 weeks in California. Right. So I was like, I want to spend as little as possible. Yeah. So I can stay for as long as I can. Yeah. So I basically hadn't picked up my car yet. And I was like, right, I'm going to stay in Berkeley. So I booked this Airbnb, and unfortunately, where I was staying, they basically had a newborn baby. Yeah, so I'm totally serious. It's terrible. It's the first time it's ever happened to me, anything like that, right? And I turned up there at like 10 o'clock at night. The guy was trying to charge me extra because I was an hour later than my time. Yeah, that's the first thing. And I sent him an email saying, look, I'm really sorry, I'm going to be a bit later. And he said, oh, well, we're going to charge you an extra, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, hey, what's going on here? Like, you don't charge someone extra for being an hour late on Airbnb, do you? That's just crazy. No, yeah. It's crazy. So then I turn up there and I get there and get into my room. Lovely room, beautiful, absolutely beautiful garden, everything, right? And then this is the night after Oracle Open World finish, yeah. And I get there and literally, so first thing, I go to sleep, and like an hour later I wake up with this screaming newborn just above me, yeah, like 3 week old newborn, yeah. So I was like, oh no. And I put on these very headphones, I kid you not. And I just did some work. It was all I could do because I tried to sleep and I just got woken up every hour. And it was torture. It was torture, right? Because I was so tired anyway. It was just, you know, torture. So then in the morning, 6 o'clock, I got woken up again. Yeah. After this 1 hourly feeds, obviously. Yeah. And I was like, right, I'm going into Berkeley. So I walked into Berkeley, and in Berkeley, there's this train. Yeah. And they have a train. Have you been to Berkeley?
No, I haven't been. No.
Okay. So there's this train that goes through Berkeley. Yeah. But because someone was killed on the train tracks, right, they push the horn on this train. Yeah. And if you don't live in Berkeley, right, this is like an alarm. like you literally, you jump out of your skin. Like, it's so loud every time a train goes past. Yeah. Because it's a massive long train track. There are no borders and barriers. And it's just this massive loud siren going off.
Oh,
you wouldn't
know.
So that's the first thing. Then I ended up in a coffee shop, and I was like, this is no good. I'll go into the ice store. So I literally just, I was like, I'm going to make myself feel better. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I went to the ice store and I queued up and got my iWatch. And that's my funny story for the day. Right. So the future of medicine, yeah, is super, right? Like, if you can put what you're doing into the wider space, and you can plug in the watches, you can plug in like thermometers, smart thermometers, and you can plug in like insurance and all of these things, then that's where we've been talking about this, haven't we, people in tech, for years. Yeah. Okay. Like connected insurance. Yeah. And then people are like, oh, but I don't want you sharing my data if I work out 10 hours a week instead of five, or five instead of 10, or I don't work out. Like, but the future is preserving life, isn't it? With holistic approach to all of this, right?
Exactly. So the thing about the Mars project is, once you are getting to a point where you need to revascularize your leg, or you're having an amputation, you're a bit too late.
What's revascularizing?
Oh, right. Sorry. So it's getting more blood down to the leg.
Okay.
So the reason why many people end up with an amputation is that when you smoke, for example, your arteries get clogged up, so there's not enough blood going down, and when there's not enough blood going down, you start to develop ulcers or gangrene, and then that leads to an amputation. Yeah. So when you revascularize, you basically, it's just fancy plumbing, really. All you're doing is opening up the pipes to get more blood down, and you can do that either through balloons and stents, or through keyhole surgery, or you do a bypass, or you cut out the blockage. So
right.
It's essentially plumbing. That's exactly right.
Right, got you.
So what we've done with Mars is look across not just what happens in hospital, but look across the entire patient journey. So you need to look at what's happened to them before they come into hospital. So before they get to the point where they need to see me. And then you need to go back one step further back, is look at the risk factors that lead to the conditions that ultimately lead to the amputation. So that is what we call a whole systems analysis. And that's what's completely new about Mars.
Got
so
you.
Most surgeons only look at their own world, which is just in the hospital, just doing very high tech stuff, which is great.
Yeah.
But if you look at the entire patient journey, what you need to do is affect all of that. And then how can you apply tech to all of that? And that's what we're doing. So what we've done with Mars is look at, so for example, the pathway is, say somebody smokes, and from that they become overweight, they then develop diabetes, and then they develop problems with the blood supply, and then they end up with an amputation. So those are four points, and they are you're a different part of the health service at each one of those. So one is when you're relatively well, a bit overweight, and you're smoking, you don't come into contact with the health service at all. Once you develop a problem, you either go to your GP or to a community, and you usually treat it in the community. And if that doesn't work, you come into hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons why we've got so many inequalities and amputations is that there's so much variation in how people are treated and how in access to services and all that kind of stuff. And people doing the same thing, but doing it differently, but are not all doing it to the best of how it should be done. It's not all evidence-based. So what we've done with Mars is look at all those pathways, get all the pathways absolutely standard to make sure everybody's singing from the same hymn sheet. And then we say, right, how do we apply tech to that? Now that we know what we want to do, what do we need the tech to do? Because the tech is actually quite easy, right?
Right.
But what do you actually need it to do? And so the two things that we want tech to do is, number one, give us an up-to-date, give us a dashboard of who's out there, what the problems that they have. And then the second thing is, how can we discharge people from the service safely, but keep an eye on them remotely? And how can we get those people to safely look after themselves and then re-refer themselves into the service safely? Because if we can't look after everybody all the time, because that's just too much. We just don't have the manpower to do that. So people have to take care of themselves, and that's how tech can help. So we've looked at the entire pathway and understood that if you want to reduce amputations, it's all about aggregation of marginal gains. Every step of the pathway that patients have, and I work with quite a few companies, and in fact, one of the companies, their products touch the patient at 18 different data points. And so we can work with companies and say, right, how can you help us with this pathway? And then that develops into, outcomes-based procurement and all that kind of stuff. But looking at that entire pathway is what's absolutely crucial. And once you know what you're looking at, you can then ask the question, what can tech actually do? And that's where we are.
Yeah. So starting with the outcome in mind, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's absolutely crucial to know what the outcome is and then work backwards from there. And this is, I know, feel free to ask a question, but
I'm listening.
Yeah.
I might look a bit blank, but it's because I'm listening really hard.
Okay. So one of the key things we want to do is to be able to safely discharge people from the system, and they can re-refer themselves into the system. And the key thing is if they develop a foot ulcer. So once you've healed a foot ulcer, patients are at risk of developing a new foot ulcer. Now, there's two ways of doing that. Many people have a yearly foot check where if they've got diabetes, they have a yearly foot check to see if they've got a foot ulcer and to give them advice on how to manage that. But many people who are looking after themselves, if you've got diabetes, your eyesight isn't very good and you can't actually see what's going on with your feet. So we thought, well, can we develop an app to help us with that? So what they've done at Manchester Met University, a guy with Professor Niels and Moy Hoon with Oracle, is that they've developed something called FootSnap AI, which is where you can take a picture of a wound and the app will tell you whether there is an ulcer on there or not. And so you can either take the picture of the wound of your foot yourself, or you can get somebody else to do it for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that will automatically say, yes, there is an ulcer, or no, there isn't. And then you can be referred into the pathway. And that also helps with management as well. So you've got something that's been trained to do that. And it's got what we call good sensitivity and specificity. So the app will say, there's an ulcer if I say there's an ulcer, but more importantly, it will tell you if there's not an ulcer there, And so you safely know that somebody does not have an ulcer. And that's absolutely, that's going to be a complete game changer for us.
Wow. That's basically part of what we talked about before we started recording. Yeah. And there are so many opportunities once you've actually got the data that you can analyze. Like you can, I was saying like about psoriasis, for example, one example, you could take a picture of something that you think might be psoriasis and that could go into a database. And then eventually you're going to be able to have a 99% chance that is predicted correctly, right? Based upon the image, because image tech is so good nowadays. Yeah. That is just that. So basically you're trying to reduce footfall here. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, with that, in the hospital I work at, there's 23,000 employees just in the hospital themselves, and we serve from a vascular point of view, we were serving a population of 2.8 million, and there's multiple clinics not only in the hospital but all outside in the community as well. And many of these patients are frail; it's difficult for them to get out, and people with lower limb disease are often the poorest of people. So, getting a taxi to come to see you in clinic may cost £10-15. And that's a huge amount of money if your income is really, really low. And you've got to do that, two, three times a week sometimes. And so it's just a lot. And then you've got all the, all the carbon footprint associated with that, all the issues around traffic and all that, that's around that. So if we can remotely manage these patients safely, that has to be the future, and that's what we're trying to do. And certainly now with the COVID crisis, I know that will hopefully it'll calm down in the coming months, but we have to reduce a footfall in the hospital completely. And some people are talking about reducing to 20% of what it actually was pre-COVID, so you can have all these social distancing, so you need fewer people going in the hospital to reduce the risk, because certainly with these patients, because they're usually old and frail, they're at high risk of developing COVID and all the associated complications as well. So these are the people that you definitely do not want to get COVID. So you just need a way of managing these patients safely, and tech is one of the answers for that.
Yeah. So what's this aneurysm screening program that you're involved with?
Sure. So it's the Greater Manchester Abdominal Aortic Aneurysm Screening Program. It's a national program, and I'm responsible for the area of Greater Manchester, where we screen about 15,000 people every year. Mm-hmm. And the program, essentially, every man aged 65 will get an invite where we then do an ultrasound of your tummy and you pick up an aneurysm. Now, an aneurysm is a swelling in your blood vessel. So if you're from your heart, you've got basically one blood vessel that comes out of your heart, goes out of your chest, down your chest, down your tummy, and then to go into each leg. Mm-hmm. Now, the bit in your tummy, the blood vessel, is normally about the thickness of your thumb, is about 2-3 centimeters.
Okay.
As you get older, that can grow, and an aneurysm is when you get a swelling in that blood vessel, and the swelling is basically like a balloon. So balloon, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and at some point, it'll pop. Wow. And that's quite dangerous when it pops. And many patients, when they get that, they actually bleed to death and they die. Now, what you
Gross,
can do,
man.
So it's pretty serious. But yeah, sorry, I should have prepared you for that, shouldn't I?
I feel a bit sick now. Like, seriously.
But these aneurysms, they take years to grow. So when they're about 5.5 centimeters, that's the tipping point for when they should be repaired, but they grow at about 2-3 millimeters a year. Mm-hmm. So between 3 and 5.5 centimeters, it can take 10-15 years to grow. Mm-hmm. So at the age of 65 is what we do now is screen all men for it, and those that have it, we'll keep an eye on them. Some of them will have it where it needs to be fixed straight away, and the aim is once you know about it, you can fix it in a time that where it doesn't burst, and you reduce the aneurysm related mortality, and that's what we are doing, result from it, because it's something that if you pick it up early, you can fix it and you can save lives, and if you don't pick it up and it bursts, people die. And that's what the screening program does. So and where tech can help with this, linking on with the Mars project, is because you're screening 15,000 men every year age 65 and over. These are the people that are going to develop health problems in 10 to 15 years time, which are not aneurysm related. So the question is, can we identify their risk factors before we see them, using tech to, you know, look at the health records, looking at all the other records that we have about them, to develop a picture of these people? And then can we give them a tailored public health health improvement program so they can improve their risk factors? And then can we monitor them remotely to make sure that their health is improving so they don't develop the health problems 15, 20 years down the line? Now, the technology is there to do that. We've all got apps and we've all got phones that can do that. But making that systematic as part of the health program, which may involve giving some of these non-tech people techie lessons, giving them the phones, giving them the tech, and then you can sort of, you know, this is proper public health, proper population health, you know, population-based transformation. That's what we want to try and do, and this is a ready population where we can apply the tech to on a big scale, and you'll reap the benefits 10, 15 years later.
Yeah, I get it, because then you can find all sorts of you can extract all sorts of insights, can't you? It's like, you know, if this guy does that and he lives here and he has fish and chips twice a week and drinks four cans of beer a day, then we know that if he drank one can of beer less per day, then he's not going to, you know, perhaps be in this position. Yeah. Just as an example, right? That's very interesting.
That's exactly it. And what we want to do is build on that as well. So linking with the Mars project and the screening program, what you can do is people who have, say, the prevalence of diabetes within a particular area is going to be quite high within Greater Manchester. You always got sort of hot pockets. So you've got that. And then we know how many people within that same area have wounds. So you can put the health data on top of that. Mm-hmm. Then you can put on top of that supermarket data. You can put on weather data, and then you can look at the effects of humidity and housing on wounds, and how those patients will then get on public transport to come into your hospital. So you can start building huge data sets to understand where the problems are, how it all affects it, and then you can put that all into a computer model. And once you do that, you can predict what's going to happen. What variables can you change to, you know, what do you need to change and how will that affect things? And that's what we want to try and do. So using big data, using multiple data sources, and what we've got in Greater Manchester is, with the Lord Mayor, he can put all the people together in a room and say, guys, share your data. And then we've got the techie to say, right, we've got the data, now what can we do with it? Those are the sort of things that we're thinking about at the moment and trying to put into practice.
Well, that's good. I'm going to introduce you to Nicholas Babin. He's working on a diabetes thing at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah. It'd be a very good introduction for you, actually.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, my pleasure. So will these recommendations happen then earlier on in life? Like, it's almost like you've got to go through the next 10 years or 5 years or 3 years of learning. And then you go back and you say, well, actually this guy at the age of 20, he stopped doing this. And then you can go back and say, well, okay, you're 20 and we know that your father had this and he didn't do this. And you, if you do that, then this is where you're going to end up, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's all about building risk factor profiles. But the real challenge for all this, people, if you just give people data and tell them if you do things, you'll be better, that's often not enough. Because, you know, most people, you know, most people act illogically and irrationally, right? So people know that smoking is bad for you, yet people still smoke. And people know that exercise is good for you, but not all people exercise. So how do you translate that into, you know, motivational behavior? How do you get people to do, you know, it's all behavioral change science, right? That's what that is. And how do you get people to do that? Now, if you've got an aneurysm that's, you know, that's, that needs repair in, you know, 12 months or 24 months, you've got an incentive. So those patients, if you put those people onto an exercise program, they often do really well. Whereas if you don't have that as, you know, a goal, how can we get those people to do something? And those are the sort of ideas we're working on. Because with all these, ultimately, the tech is easy, right? And the tech is available and we can apply it. But what does it actually mean? How can it actually translate into behavior change? And, you know, if somebody's got an answer for that, that'd be brilliant. Because, my approach to all this is simple, you know, everything in moderation, including moderation, right? So,
yes.
So we just need to try and work out what motivates particular people in particular ways. And certain messages work better for certain people, whereas other methods work better for other people. And we've got another program working with schools to try and understand behavior change models and using the Myers-Briggs to be able to deliver health messages personalized for kids, and then applying that to adults as well.
Oh, super. Well, we should talk about that another time. Sure. Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, I've got to write some questions for an interview later with a cricket player.
Okay.
So I'm going to have to go, but thank you. That's been wonderful. And if people want more information, how do they get hold of you?
So you can use just, I'm on Twitter. That's probably the easiest way. And I'm at NAS_vascular. That's probably the easiest way to get hold of me.
Super, super. Thanks for listening. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections too. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thank you.